Boing Boing's Get Illuminated podcast, episode 1, recorded on September 26, 2006. I'm Mark Frauenfelder. With me is my co-host, David Peskovitz, who's a co-editor of Boing Boing.
Hello.
Hi, David.
Hi, happy to be here.
Good. Joining us today is our guest, Douglas Rushkoff.
Hey.
Hi, Doug. Doug wears many hats. He's written 10 best-selling books on new media and popular culture, including Siberia, Media Virus, Playing the Future, Nothing Sacred, Coercion, and Get Back in the Box. He's also written two novels, Ecstasy Club and Exit Strategy, as well as a hit monthly comic for Vertigo called Testament. Doug's written and co-hosted two award-winning frontline documentaries, The Merchants of Cool, which looked at the influence of corporations on youth culture, and The Persuaders, about the cluttered landscape of marketing and new efforts to overcome consumer resistance. In addition, Doug founded the Narrative Lab at New York University's Interactive Telecommunications Program. He appears regularly on radio and television, and he writes a monthly column for Discover magazine. There are so many things we want to talk to Doug about, so we'll dive right in. Thanks for being on our very first podcast, Doug.
It's an honor.
Great.
This is really exciting because Doug, among all those other accomplishments, he's an old friend of Boing Boing, even back when we were a print zine.
Yeah, we've known Doug for a long time. Doug, the first thing I wanted to ask you about is this renewed interest in Timothy Leary, you know, with the two biographies that are out, and the resurgence of interest in psychedelics as a tool for both spiritual discovery and in psychotherapy. I'm wondering why you think this is happening now.
Yeah, Doug, you were friends with Tim. In fact, I was with you at his house at least on a couple occasions, and you know, now we're starting to hear his name once again.
I know, it is kind of funny. I mean, there's definitely at least two Timothy Learys out there, and a guy who approached issues and technologies and people with the ferocity that he did, was, you know, bound to get, you know, varied responses to his work and his life. It kind of reminds me, I was just reading a biography of Aleister Crowley last night, and, you know, just a few years after Crowley died, this really scathing biography by a guy named Simmons came out, you know, really, you know, playing up Crowley as this beast, devil, evil, you know, human. And then, you know, sure enough, you know, 20 years later, the hippies end up kind of incorporating Crowley's individualism and quest for agency into their whole sort of schema of, you know, we're going to be new humans and launch this new age. And it's like both of these diametrically opposed views of Crowley are wrong. You know, he was neither, you know, the prophetic harbinger of, you know, the next dawning of the human species, nor was he the devil incarnate. And I feel like, you know, Timothy Leary is now going through his devil incarnate stage, where, you know, people are coming up with biographies saying, oh, he was this nasty guy and he turned in the, you know, the Weather Underground, and you know, people focusing on these the kind of the minutiae of a life spent, you know, in great struggle and great peril, and making all the same wrong decisions that all of us make as we plod through life, but, you know, doing them a bit more under the spotlight. And that it's going to take even a few more years for his contributions to trickle back up, you know, back up from the grave, and for us to see what it was that he was, you know, trying to accomplish as a psychologist, you know, witnessing man's, you know, awesome power for self-destruction, and trying to develop new models, new, you know, reality tunnels through which we could escape what seemed to him at the time like almost certain nuclear annihilation at our own hands. You know, it was a heavy load he tried to take, and he wobbled a bit, and, you know, certainly. You know, and now along with the people who are, you know, condemning the psychedelic survival and condemning the 60s, you know, are a new breed of psychedelic evangelists who are almost really more stridently fundamentalist than Terence McKenna at his worst, you know, where they really seem to believe that if you haven't had a DMT psychedelic experience, you're not going to make it through the bottleneck at the end of time as prophesized by the Mayan Sulkin calendar. So I think that these diametrically opposed and, you know, extremely polarized experiences of psychedelics and views of psychedelics are going to have to eventually get a bit less strident if we're going to come to a more meaningful conversation about the role of psychedelics in prophecy and really open-mindedness towards mutation, really towards illumination in our culture.
Well, it's interesting that you know, it always seems like the New Agers always get a hold of any new technology, whether it's or interesting technology, whether it's psychedelics, whether it's computers, whether it's quantum physics, and sort of ruin it by layering it with this, you know, almost evangelical, you know, holier than thou, you know, patina on top of the whole thing.
Yeah, well, in a sense, we, and I count myself as, you know, one of the guilty parties in some of that, at least sometimes, and certainly in my earlier days, you know, we're also highly immersed in the propaganda reality in which we live, and we know that the ideas and technologies, that anything cool that we find, in a sense, needs to be publicized, needs to be evangelized in order to get promoted, whether we do it through, you know, bottom-up viral marketing and word of mouth or trying to turn on our friends to it. It's like, you know, we're all out there exploring and you find a really cool nugget and you want to share it with others. You know,
but isn't there a difference between saying, hey, there's this cool thing I want to share with you, and hey, you better participate in this movement or buy into this dogma or you're going to be screwed, you know, in the end.
There's a big difference. I mean, and that's, you know, and that's really the line that Boing Boing is trying to stay on, or the margins within which Boing Boing is trying to live. Saying, here are these cool things we found. Here's sort of our opinion, if not really a rating, but our sense of how they might be, you know, positively contributing to our collective illumination, and we think it's worthy of being checked out. You know, it's not a matter of saying all that or else. Or else, yeah. Humanity will careen off the very edge of the earth and we'll all die in a plague of PCBs.
Interesting.
So
interesting.
David told me that you're going to have a debate with Daniel Pinchbeck.
Well, it's funny. I don't know if it's going to be a debate or a conversation.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I try, you know, failingly, but I certainly try to engage with people in a manner consistent with the values I'm espousing. In other words, the medium is the message. So when I, you know, came out with a book on Judaism, saying that Judaism is this great open source tradition, sort of like the U.S. Constitution, it's meant to be changed and altered by each generation as wisely as they can, I met with severe criticism from rabbis. So I would go and do panels with, you know, rabbis of various sects who would just come out clobbering at me, like, oh my God, how can you say this? And, you know, you're not a Jew if you don't think Israel is right in this decision, and just wailing on me. And usually what I would try to do is, you know, just engage openly with their ideas and try to share mine and not be combative. I kind of feel like Hegel has had his day, and that the dialectic, this whole idea of, well, I'm going to play devil's advocate to your position in order to prove mine, isn't necessarily the most productive form of engagement. So while I do believe that Daniel has, you know, fallen prey to some of the almost inevitable traps of frequent and well-meaning psychedelic inquiry, I don't think it's my job to, you know, try to publicly humiliate him or discredit his inquiries as much as to offer alternative ways of understanding and implementing or applying these experiences.
Doug, I'm interested in, you know, how you moved from, you know, in many ways, your books were commenting on media, commenting on pop culture, and particularly youth culture early on. And then you moved into this, you know, role as you know, comic book author, and that's really taken off, you know, very quickly. And I wonder how you made that transition, and if it seems like, you know, a continuation on your previous path, or if it's a jog for you.
It's pretty much a continuation, believe it or not. At least I see it that way. I mean, on a certain level, I think all my books, all my media, everything I'm doing is saying the same thing, which is that reality, the world we live in, is an open source proposition, that the codes by which we live are up for discussion and they're not set in stone. And whether it was me finding the first San Francisco Siberian cyberpunks who, you know, believed that mutation was within our conscious ability, or whether it was encountering media activists who saw in the newly networked media landscape ways for regular people with a computer and a modem to infiltrate what it seemed like an impenetrable media circus, or whether it's talking to devout members of a religion and reminding them that these religions were written down by people with the full intent that they would be amended and added to and commented upon by successive generations, or being a fiction writer writing stories that are generally more concerned with the characters liberating themselves from what seems like the narrative line that they're fated to play and achieving some measure of agency against the idols and icons and sort of mythological constructs that they've accepted as given circumstances. So for me, it's a by any means necessary communication I'm trying to make to my peers. And that is that it's not too late. The window of opportunity is still open for us to consciously engage in mankind's next great renaissance. And that would be not just as its consumers, but as its programmers.
So that, I think you're exploring those themes in your comic book for Vertigo, Testament, too.
Definitely.
I think it's interesting that, you know, your story, I think 8 or 9 issues have been published so far, and it's a story about the near future that parallels the stories in the Old Testament. You know, why did you decide to create a comic book that kind of retold these stories in an updated fashion?
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, originally I had pitched, let me just do the Bible as a comic book, because I can show people what the Bible really says in a comic book, because there's human beings who are sort of passing through linear time, and I could put them in the panels, living sequential narrative, and then there's these gods and spirits and all who are living outside time, and I could put them outside the panels and have them only be able to sort of penetrate the panel borders as elements. So like a god could reach their hand into a panel and it would show up as fire or water or an emotion, you know, and get sort of a great burning bush scene of God pushing his hand through a panel, but it only shows up as fire in a bush, and that's the way Moses talks to him. And it really was the editor's idea to, in order to make it more accessible and to make the sort of allegorical possibilities more explicit, would be to parallel it with a modern story. You know, I was going to imply things about the modern times, but I really wasn't going to have that. But then once I started to lay out a modern story, I realized, oh, this is really good. Because now what I can do is have modern characters whose stories, whose narrative echoes the narratives of the Bible. So I can keep kind of flashing back to these Bible scenes, have my modern characters basically be the actors playing the parts in the Bible scenes, let them play multiple characters, and then really show what I think the Bible's importance is. And that's not that this stuff happened at some moment in historical time, but rather that these biblical stories, they reveal the dynamics that are underlying all of our relationships and our relationships to the world and to God and to each other, all the time, so that we're all Cain dealing with jealousy for a brother. You know, we're all, you know, Moses trying to convince people of something that we understand or that we see. You know, we're all, you know, Jacob sort of stealing the blessing from our brother. And it ended up just really making sense once I started with the real basics of the Bible, which is, you know, God telling people to stop sacrificing their kids to false idols, and then looking on the front page of the paper and seeing us sending, you know, our youth off to a war for basically for oil or who knows what, you know, when a civilization is sacrificing its youngsters for false idols, you know, at least in biblical terms, you're in trouble. So it ended up being a really good idea to have those two stories together. And the greatest thing it does is it lets me allow the modern characters to actually break free of the story, which is what's happening now by issues 9 and 10, is they are not behaving in the same way as their biblical counterparts. And the gods are getting really freaked out. So, you know, where Joseph, you know, invites all his brothers down to Egypt after the, you know, when the famine is happening, and says, come on down and we'll take care of you, which of course is what leads to the Israelites becoming slaves for 400 years. What I do in the modern story is there's an equivalent scene, except the brothers refuse. The brothers say, this is crap, we're not going to come down, we're not going to take part in this, and instead rescue the Joseph character from his predicament and make him one of the rebels. So I actually now, I'm allowing the plots to diverge, which is really fun, and shows that we're not always limited to the stories, you know, that even our gods would have us live out.
So that's hopeful. You're not like stuck in this endless loop of kind of cosmic history repeating itself over and over again. And
well, it's the idea, I guess, is that we have been, but that at any moment we also have the ability to break out of that cosmic loop. And that's what becoming conscious is really about. What becoming conscious is about is rising up from the flatness of the story, or breaking out of the panel of the comic book and learning how to guide the story ourselves rather than just being subjected to it.
What's your new comic book, Doug? I know that you're launching another one. I don't know if you can talk about that yet, but
well, I think it's supposed to be secret, but it's approved, but it hasn't been announced.
So can you give us a hint? Give us a hint.
Yeah, I'll give you a hint. The big hint would be, what is the ultimate fantasy life for any, say, 14 or 15 year old crazed video game enthusiast? And that would be to live in a world where it was your job from birth to test video games. And the only time you have to leave your terrific testing laboratory would be to go to conventions and demonstrate the latest whiz-bang gizmos on the, you know, on the Xbox 3000. And then what if you found out all of a sudden that when you turn 17, there's a bit of a Logan's Run to the scenario. And you are no longer valuable to the corporation. You're no longer valuable to the corporation as a member of this prized media savvy demographic.
Amazing.
So it's really about a group of kids who are really looking to figure out what was their origin, what were they born for, and what can they do about it.
Are you working on another novel as well, or another piece of nonfiction or a documentary? What's next?
I'm just signing with a literary agent named John Brockman, who is he's sort of the literary agent to the scientific and intellectual greats, and he's a guy who he throws a sentence at you and you. It's almost like dropping an acid. You have a soul-searching month of, who am I? What is my contribution to this society? What can I really do?
It's interesting. So yeah, I mean, Shenny posted a link about John Brockman, you know, in his work in the 60s with experimental cinema and sort of the Warhol downtown scene. I mean, he's not new to this game. He's old school multimedia.
Old school. He was like one of the main, producers of the Monkees movie Head, and you know, he was in with the Easy Rider crowd and started
the
Reality Club. Yeah, I mean, and he's never taken a psychedelic in his life. Interestingly enough, he decided he wanted to be a member of the control group. And prove that he could be just as weird and profound without ever having taken a drug. And so far that's proven. But what I want to do is I kind of want to write the equivalent of Walter Ong's Orality and Literacy or McLuhan's Understanding Media for our era. You know, I do think there's been a true shift in the way media works and in the effect and influence of the tools that we're using on how we think about our world and the possibilities for us to make it a better place. So what I want to do is look, I want to write a book that isn't about something other than what it's about. You know, I wrote Get Back in the Box, which is a book that's supposedly a business book, but it's really about, you know, how to still profit in a world after capitalism. You know, it's really about undermining centralized currency. Or Media Virus, which, you know, is ostensibly a book about O.J. Simpson and Woody Allen and Madonna and Michael Jackson, but it's really trying to look at the sort of more almost organismic qualities of the media space in which we live. You know, and any of these books, even Siberia, which is an argument for grasping the reins of a designer reality and is kind of packaged instead like a Romana Clef or something or an expose on early cyberdelic culture. So here what I want to do is actually just write the book. In other words, without it being framed by something else. And that is a book that looks at the recent, meaning the last sort of 50 years of technology and interactivity and how that really, how the cut and paste dream of, you know, William Burroughs and Brian Geisen has come to pass, and how the feedback that guys like Norbert Wiener talked about is no longer just part of this big system, but is the principal actor in the system in which we live. You know, and to look at what happens when a society moves from being an oral culture to being a literate culture to being what they called a secondary oral culture, which was people using scripts and stuff to then talk on TV, to now being what we almost have to call a secondary literate culture, you know, where the way we contextualize things, the way we link to things, can almost provide them with their context and meaning.
It sounds kind of like the book you've been waiting to write your whole life.
In a sense, yeah, and I'm glad I'm not getting to write it until now, until I've had time to read people like Walter Benjamin and Adorno and Horkheimer, people who really looked at the influence of the market on all this stuff. Because most media theorists, you know, we just kind of live in a vacuum, and we think everything has to do with whether, you know, your fax has callback features or not, and whether that's going to change reality. And the mistake we make, like I think I made in Siberia, was in looking at the influence of all these technologies, but not taking into account the sort of the wired revolution that was really going to happen. What was going to happen when you add Wall Street and venture capitalism and centralized currency to this whole mix? So I'm going back, and as I analyze each medium, I'm also going to analyze how does that change money. I mean, I want to include money itself as a medium, because that's what it is. You know, once we get the printing press, what did we get? We got centralized printed currencies, and that changed everything. So, you know, sort of taking money in as part of media study rather than letting the finance community take media in as just one of its investment portfolios, I think can help recontextualize societal change as a media phenomenon rather than an economic phenomenon.
Interesting. So rather than follow the money, it's about following the media.
Yeah, and when you follow the media, what you're really following is you're following the ways in which human beings are trying to connect with one another. So then you can look at something even totally radically awful, like, you know, Bush listening in on our phone calls and security cameras all over the place, and say, okay, the excuse to do all this stuff is that we're scared about terrorism, all right? But put the excuse that we're doing it aside for a minute and look at what are we actually doing? We are linking ourselves up in every conceivable way. You know, we are actually forging intimacy. You know, whether it's breaking privacy rules and whether we're doing it, you know, because we're gonna, you know, catch someone smoking pot or having sex backwards or hatching a terrorist plot, in one sense is besides the point. What I'm looking at instead is what is the bias of the medium itself. So with each thing, whether it's a bank telling machine or the camera looking at us using the bank telling machine or the camera looking at the lobby of our building or a program like RIA that allows us to do face recognition with our Flickr pictures, what are we actually doing as a society, and how could this be used, the same technology, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, when the crisis of the day no longer is what's compelling us to build all this stuff. You know, what I'm looking at is a species building a tremendous interactive infrastructure, and I don't believe the current line on why humans are doing it.
Wow.
Interesting.
We're great. Starting to run out of time, but I did want to ask you about your new monthly column for Discover magazine and the kinds of things that you're going to be covering in your column.
It's really fun. You know, I met Bob Guccione Jr. originally through Tim Leary, and he was a fan of my work and liked a lot of my magazine stuff. It was just, must have been, you know, 15 years ago, and he said, yeah, but, you know, I've never seen you write the column that you really should be writing. You know, so then we were going to try to get me in Spin, but then he left Spin. Then we were going to do Gear, but then Gear folded. So then finally it looked like he was going to buy Omni or reinvent Omni, but then instead he bought Discover. And he told me the column he wanted me to do, which was kind of fun. So in some ways, I feel like I'm taking his guidance as an intelligent admirer of my work and the direction he wants to push me. And what he wants me to do is a column in the big sort of reviews section, which is the back of the book. So rather than a sort of random front of the book musing, he wants me to start each article with a cultural artifact. You know, whether it's, you know, I'm doing one on the RIA program or a Stephen Johnson book or, gosh, you know, anything out there that's of interest, and start it as if it's almost like a product review, but then actually analyze the object sort of for its place in the cultural landscape. In other words, what is its real purpose? So the underlying theme of every column is that human beings are, one way or another, slouching towards a more organismic relationship with each other. So that while, say, Seed Magazine, which is great at what it does, Seed Magazine is really about the culture of science, right? Who are these guys? Where do they party? How do they live? Where were they raised? What I'm trying to write about is the science of culture. How are we still in a petri dish? You know, and how are we as an organism developing? You know, is there an emergent life form here? Or even is there an emergent intelligence in humanity? You know, and are we, do we have any signs out there of things that we can point to and say, this is a sign that we are attempting to reconcile with one another. This is a sign that we are looking at each other differently. So it's really about looking at cultural artifacts as if they were in a petri dish, and then understanding them as part of what I hope is a positive reconciliation of human beings into a more collaborative and cooperative arrangement.
Yeah, because otherwise, if we don't work, the would just get flushed down the drain like any sort of non-growing organism in a petri dish.
Totally, And if nothing else, you know, what Bob is hoping is that people will be able to look at the column I wrote, you know, 3 years ago and say, oh, that's what was going on then. That's what was really happening at that moment.
So when is the first column appearing?
It appeared last month, and the second column is on the stands right now.
Oh, cool.
Excellent.
And so before we go, the one thing that I do have to ask you is I read recently on your blog at rushkoff.com that you aren't convinced that Ken Lay is really dead. Are you serious?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, not to play a conspiracy theory. It's not even about that. It started, you know, I heard the radio report that, you know, Ken Lay is dead. And then I couldn't help but thinking, how totally convenient, you know? And if anyone could stage his own death in order to avoid spending the rest of his life in jail, in order to avoid having to have his family pay back all their money to the duped Enron investors and employees, in order to prevent Dick Cheney and his clan from being exposed for the meetings they had about energy policy early on in the Bush administration, isn't it convenient that a billionaire should be able to get out of it? I mean, come on. I mean, any decent spy movie, you know, would have a premise like this, and no one would even bat an eye, right? You wouldn't even consider it a problematic plot point. So how hard is it for him to
either... I think it was the plot of Fletch.
Yeah. How hard is it to pay off a coroner or to find another dead body that's kind of like yours and screw up with the fingerprints or whatever? I mean, whatever technologies are out there, this guy's got access to it. But more importantly than whether or not he's alive or dead was my sense that day. And it was like the same day that we were hearing about the Korean nuclear test missile launch and that it didn't really work, but that maybe we were going to shoot it down. And I was thinking, well, maybe they did launch and we did shoot it down, and now they can't say it, because if the Koreans say that, then it proves that we know how to shoot their stuff down and that our missiles work. So maybe we're playing that game when something was going on in Israel. And I realized, we've got no idea what's going on. In other words, the news stories that we get may or may not be connected to any reality on the ground. And that's what sort of led me into realizing that it's all up for grabs, that the propaganda state really has been created, and that if a guy as dedicated to figuring things out as I am, has literally thrown up his arms and gone, I've really got no way of knowing what's going on anywhere except on the street where I live, it means that I don't know how many people out there really are in touch either.
Yeah. Well, I'll bet that Jeff Skilling is pissed off because he can't use that trick now.
Well, we don't know how many times it's been used before.
Yeah.
Exactly. But it's also, you know, it's quite possible the guy's dead. I mean, quite simply, you know, that he took, you know, a dose of whatever, potassium or something, and, you know, zapped his heart, because... You know, while I go on like that, and it would be better for his family and everybody else to take that way out.
Uh-huh. But it's more, you know, it's more interesting to imagine that he might be alive and the reasons why and how he did it.
Right. And if I were an oil baron sociopath, I would certainly explore every opportunity for survival after such a catastrophe rather than death.
Yeah, definitely.
Mark,
and
maybe
he's
we should
got a
preview
lot more
our...
means. At, you know, he's got way more means at his disposal than any of us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mark, maybe we should preview what's coming up next on the next episode of Get Illuminated. We have our friend Lauren Coleman, who's a world-renowned cryptozoologist. So Lauren's going to be talking to us about Bigfoot, Mothman, and other unknown animals that may be lurking in our backwoods and in the ocean and in the sky.
That's going to be fun. All right.
Exactly.
Well, Doug, thanks so much for talking with us, and good luck on all of your projects. It sounds like you're...
Oh, thank you, and thank you for the honor of initiating this new media venture.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, if you'd like to keep tabs on what Doug is up to and communicate with him, visit rushkoff.com.